Thank you for joining us today for our final classical conversation of the 2017 Summer Festival. I'm Seneca Garber, the Director of Marketing at Seattle Chamber Music Society, and I'm your host today, filling in for Dave Beck. We'd like to thank King FM for supporting these podcasts and this whole series that we've been doing over the last few years. Today we're joined by cellist Astrid Schwein, an internationally recognized soloist, chamber artist, and teacher who in the fall of 2016 succeeded Joel Krosnick as the cellist of the Juilliard String Quartet, and at that same time also joined the Juilliard cello faculty. Astrid made her New York Philharmonic debut under the direction of Zubin Mehta and received her bachelor's and master's degrees from the Juilliard School. Her teachers have included Harvey Shapiro, Leonard Rose, Ardith Alton, Eugene Moy, Bernard Greenhouse, William Pleath, and Jacqueline Dupree, a veritable who's who of cellist instructors. She was a longtime member of the Lark Quartet and performed at major venues around the world, winning a number of honors, including the Naumburg Chamber Music Award and the gold medal at Russia's Shostakovich International String Quartet Competition. Recently, she appeared as a guest speaker at the Library of Congress on the role of women in music, and her most recent recordings are Rhapsody for Solo Cello and Electronics by Gordon Green and a disc with the Boston Trio. Please join me in welcoming Astrid Schwein to our podcast today.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Senator.
Yeah, thank you for joining us. It's great to have you. I know it's been a busy week, so...
It has been a busy week. It's been a great week.
But. Well, that's what we like to hear. Lots of stuff in this bio that I'd love to cover, so it makes sense just to sort of jump right in.
Okay.
You know, as I said, that's sort of a who's list of who you've had as teachers.
Yes.
Pretty amazing. So if you start tracing back that lineage and who they've worked with as well, I mean, it's quite...
It gets deep quickly, yes.
Pretty quickly. Very, very impressive. Can you, you know, maybe talk about some of the highlights? You know, who were some of the first teachers? What really sparked your desire to be a cellist and sort of that path that those great musicians set you on?
Okay. Well, I was very fortunate. As you mentioned, I did study with a lot of these really great cellists. And I always joke that it took a lot for me to learn how to play the cello, but that's not exactly true. My first lessons were with Yo-Yo's father, Dr. Ma. And I think he
knows a little bit about cello.
He knows, yes, he was a wonderful teacher. I was with him just for 1 year when I was 7. And during that time, he not only taught me how to play the instrument, but he taught me how to read multiple clefs. So I was reading treble, tenor, and bass clef by the end of the year. I was speaking in solfège. He recognized that with my ear, I had perfect pitch, and it was very easy to kind of teach me with the system that he had used for his own children. And it was just a really great experience. So I think he was a uniquely gifted teacher. And very, very well organized. I then went to Juilliard Pre-College, where Mrs. Alton, Ardith Alton, entered the picture. And I was with her for quite a while. And she was great, because she just was all about the beauty of the instrument and the sound. Making a beautiful sound was her everyday mantra. And so I worked with her for all that time, and then stayed at Juilliard, really, from pre-college, from age 7, at the end of my year with Dr. Ma, I got into pre-college, and stayed there through my master's degree. So it was a very long odyssey. Some of the other people you mentioned, Harvey Shapiro was a very formative teacher for me. I studied with him during my bachelor's time at Juilliard, and he was one of the most beautiful cellists. I don't know how many people recognize the name, but he had played with Primrose in his quartet, and he has, I think, the definitive recording of the Rachmaninoff cello sonata. I should call it the piano and cello sonata, because it's so densely written for the piano. And studying with him was actually kind of difficult, because I was 14 when I went to him. And he had a reputation for being quite hard on his students and maybe just a little bit nasty. And I quickly learned that the best way to learn from him was to listen to his playing and to try my best to emulate what he was modeling for me. And so we actually had a very nice relationship. I then went to Leonard Rose, who had edited every single cello part that I owned, had taught all of the other teachers I had worked with, except for Harvey. They were contemporaries. And, you know, that was an incredible experience. It was very short-lived, by the time I got to Mr. Rose, he was quite ill. So I had sort of a partial year with him and spent most of my time with his assistant, Channing Robbins. And Eugene Moy made it into my bio here because he was incredibly important. I met him when I was younger during my years with Mrs. Alton, and he really is the person who taught me how to practice. He showed me not only the value of being organized and systematic, but just being honest with myself and assessing whether or not I was making progress and how to assess that. So all these people were so indispensable. And finally, Dupré and Plieff came along later, and so did Greenhouse. You know, these were all such wonderful artists. And, you know, meeting Jackie really changed my life. I was 16 when I first went to have lessons with her, and as you read, I was with her on and off for 7 years, as we could sort of afford for me to go over there, and it was also dependent upon her illness and her condition, how she was feeling, but she taught me so much without actually ever playing a note for me. She wasn't able to play anymore, and so I did all the playing. We went through the major concerti and sonatas many, many times during those visits, and we listened to her recordings. And she would sing, and she would gesture with her hands, and that was just magical. So yeah. I was very lucky to have that access.
Terrific. Yeah. It's, you know, really amazing how all these different people can, you know, impart something and take these little bits to kind of form your own identity, which I think is very interesting because now you're carrying on this sort of tradition yourself as a professor. Previously at the University of Massachusetts and Mount Holyoke and some other places, as well as now at Juilliard. Yes. So how have you taken what you've learned from all of these other terrific voices and imparted that to your students and kind of the next generation?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think all of us in our field have to assimilate all of this knowledge. We have to take everything that all of our teachers taught us and what we've seen other people do on stage and come to some sort of synthesis in which we create our own persona and performance values. And so that's sort of one process for an artist. And the other is if you then pursue teaching, you know, how do you distill that into usable information for your students? So I have been pretty conscious about bringing all these great people who helped me into my current teaching menu. And I share with my students who taught me what, and I try to demonstrate and show them, and I make them aware of these great recordings. I mean, that's one thing the internet has done for us, has made so many of these you know, historical performances available, easily available for students. And of course, then the big effort is to push them into the live concert experience, because that's more of an effort nowadays than I think it was when I was a kid. You know, I was always at concerts.
Yeah, it was easier to go to a concert than pick up CD.
Yes, you know, yes.
LP in some ways. Sure. I'm curious, you know, moving from the University of Massachusetts and Mount Holyoke, where, you know, some of the students perhaps are going on to be professional cellists, but most of them are probably thinking about, you know, what else is going to happen in their career compared to Juilliard, where it's so focused and it feels like that's a place where the next step is for most of them going to be, whether it's as a soloist or a chamber musician or with an orchestra. Yeah. Do you see a difference in the way that you work with the students, or the way that the students come prepared and the way they work with you?
Yeah, yes, interesting. I think so. I mean, at UMass, as you say, some of the students were career-driven, and many of them are making a living now as successful musicians. But at Mount Holyoke in particular, I think most of those students were interested in having music as part of their background. And it was actually a really wonderful challenge to overlap, to show them ways in which what we were doing in our lessons and in our chamber music work would have relevance to them in other areas of communication. So I think, and it's such a great school too. I mean, these young women were so empowered to be leaders. Yeah. So this was a great way to use music to help them with that. But Juilliard is definitely, it's clear that everybody has their sights on a very distinct goal. And I think one of the things that I noticed right away is that there's just not enough time. And so every hour you try to squeeze out as much as you can, I tell them, I say, you know, you guys, four years here is not enough. You know, and I try to impress upon them the need to practice you know, insanely while they can, of course, you know, giving themselves room to breathe and stretch and not hurt themselves. But that's such a very important part of a person's development as an artist. So, and they have each other to spur one another on. They're very kind of inspired by one another's progress. So it's that need to say, you know, do your work is a little bit minimized. I think they're uniquely motivated.
Pushing themselves, you know, I mean, it's not, I'm assuming not, there's probably some competition as well, but at the same time, it's, you know, seeing where other people are and aspiring, I would hope.
Yeah, you know. It is actually, I think the president of Juilliard, Joseph Polisi, who's stepping down at the end of this year, he's been really, really important in serving the role of, you know, a compassionate leader. And he's taught, I think, the whole Juilliard community the importance of supporting one another. So I think when I was there, it was, I could see the comp and feel the competitive nature of the place. I couldn't feel so much compassion for the young people involved. Now it's very different.
That's good.
So, yeah.
That's great.
Yeah, it's very helpful.
One of the other, so part of the reason that you're at Juilliard is, congratulations, you are now part of the Juilliard String Quartet.
Thank you so much. What
was the audition process like to join a group like that that's been established? It's been around 70 years now.
Yes.
The previous cellist, 42 years, Joel Krosnick with them.
It's
so
incredible, yeah.
To come in, and what was the process like, and sort of what's the feeling of, you know, being the new kid on the block, I guess?
Well, of course, it was a thrill, needless to say. Just getting the phone call to see if I would be interested in reading with the group was you know, delightful. And then the process is actually kind of familiar to me because I had been in a quartet before, and we had auditioned other people who wanted to perhaps join us. So I knew what to expect from that point of view. There was repertoire that they asked me to prepare in advance, when I was given several months' notice, you know, of what I would need. There was Beethoven, Mozart, Berg, Alban Berg, and some, well, we didn't do any Brahms, we did some Schubert, and we read some Haydn together. And then after the audition, which was basically a rehearsal, you know, you sit together, the new person joins the existing three members, and you spend the day together, really, trying to see how working styles might mesh. How does this new person speak about the music? Do our sounds blend? Does this have potential? And, you know, I understood that it was a mutual audition in a sense that, I mean, you know, we all had to be happy with this, and we had to envision a sustainable future together. And one doesn't audition for something like this lightly, you know, without being prepared to follow up and say yes if the offer is made, so if it makes sense. And so they asked me to come back for another time, which I made me happy again, except I had to go back. I opened an account at the Juilliard bookstore, and I was having them send me all these scores. And so the next round of scores came in a big package. And so there was all five new pieces. And we had another session about a month and a half later. And ironically, I played the Elgar Concerto just 4 days before that audition. So I was thinking, well, this might work in my favor because at least I'll feel like the instrument's, you know, very hot in my hand. So, but it was great. And then they, you know, sort of popped the question.
How long did it take you to respond?
Well, that's a really good question. Of course, I asked for clarification. I said, I'm sorry, what did you say? And then when I was sure that I'd heard correctly, I started to answer, and it was Roger, the violist, who had called me, and he said, we don't want you to say one way or the other now. We want you to think about it, talk with your husband, you know, your family, and see if this is right for you. And I said, uh-huh. And he said, really, there's no pressure. We just want you to think. And I said, yeah. And then I just said, yes.
Offers like that don't come around.
No,
every day.
No, they don't.
So as you now have had almost a year, I guess, working with them, you know, how has the dynamic, you know, being the new person, do you feel, I mean, I guess you wouldn't know what the dynamic was like before, but, well, you know, how is the working relationship coming and developing, I guess, as you continue to deepen your knowledge of their playing as well?
Sure. Well, I mean, it's great. I love playing with them. They're three of the nicest people you could imagine working with, and they have such respect and passion for what they do. I was telling this to a student recently. I've never heard any of my colleagues play a casual note you know, just play something for the heck of it. It's always considered and full of intent, which I find so really admirable. It's amazing. But I did have a little glimpse into the previous group when I joined them last season for 3 performances of the Schubert Quintet. Mm-hmm. So I got to see Joel Krosnick in action, and I was staring at him one morning as he was getting ready to tune, and he said, "What are you staring at?" And I said, "You. I want to see exactly how you function in this ensemble." And so we were laughing about that, but it was great to sort of see that their relationship and their energy and their rhythm together.
Yeah. You alluded to the fact that you were in another quartet before, the Lark Quartet, which yes. you were in for 20 years.
Yeah, I don't know how that happened. It's a really long time.
Well, it must have been a really great experience to want to stay so long. Every group is going to be a little different, but have you seen how there's similarities or how the different groups operate that are a little different?
Yeah. That was very an interesting part of joining a quartet again after having 7 or 8 years off in between. I left the Lark in 2009, and I did almost nothing but solo performances and various small ensemble collaborations. So it was good to sort of stretch my wings that way and let that former experience kind of find its perspective in my memory. And then I think I probably also grew a lot because I was teaching and, you know, overseeing other people's development. So it sort of made sense when this opportunity came along. I felt ready to really consider it. How is it different? I mean, Juilliard, first of all, it's such a legendary group, and it's been around for so long, but it has this enormous support from the Juilliard School, which is just fantastic. I mean, it's really a fully salaried and fully, supportive in every way. So the quartet has a way of relaxing and considering what it's going to do, what kind of repertoire, where it's going to play, if certain decisions make sense for the ensemble. And the members don't have to bear quite such a heavy burden of needing to take everything in order to just stay afloat, which I think is pretty much, you know, the story for younger ensembles and artists. You know, you're just kind of scrambling. And Lark made it beyond the point of scrambling, but I think we never really had the luxury of sitting down and saying, so what will we play this season? And that was the start of a wonderful conversation I had with my new colleagues last year on the phone. We had a conference about repertoire, and they said, so Astrid, what would you like to play? And I said, wow, really? Just like that, we get to pick. So, yeah, it's quite different.
Yeah, you get to pick some things that you love and want to play and share.
Sure.
Well, I've got a little recording. I couldn't find anything yet from the Juilliard String Quartet. Hopefully we have some recordings coming.
Actually, we're just in the middle of compiling a new CD, so this is a chance to plug that, I suppose.
Sure.
Can I tell you what it is? Okay. We've recorded Opus 95 of Beethoven, a new 16-minute work by Mario Davidovsky that he wrote for us. Beautiful, beautiful piece. And then Bartok First Quartet. So that should be out in about a month and a half.
Well, we'll keep our eyes peeled.
Okay.
We don't have that at the moment, so I thought I would look back a little bit and play a sample from the Lark Quartet.
Okay.
And from the Borodin. So let's listen to just a little bit of that. Such a beautiful long line.
It's a lovely piece. I was just thinking, I'm such a sucker for that music. You know,
I think most of us are. It's beautiful, beautiful stuff. As a teacher, as a performer, all these things that are going on as a soloist, as part of a trio as well, How do you find time to balance all of this so that you have a healthy sense of your own use of time, I guess?
Well, one of the things that I had to do when taking this new position was resign from almost everything else I was doing. So I'm no longer in the Boston Trio. I left them and UMass and Mount Holyoke all in one great big farewell. Yeah. The nice thing, too, is that musicians always meet again. You know, we're always sort of bumping into each other, so those relationships are preserved. But it is challenging, especially when you're traveling. It's hard to be well-rested, deal with jet lag, and practice enough. I tend to be a big practicer, and I just feel better knowing that I've had the instrument in my hands and the material is fresh in my mind. So that takes, you know, waking up and knowing how the day is going to progress pretty much. And,
yeah, kind of structuring it out to give you what you need there.
Yeah.
Well, let's jump into another recording here.
Okay.
Listen to some music here this morning. It's always fun. We've got the Foire Trio from the Boston Trio.
Oh, great.
The fast movement, so we get to hear, you know, more of the up and down and the quicker movement as opposed to those long, beautiful lines.
Sure.
Stuff.
Thank you.
Yeah. Recently you gave a talk at the Library of Congress on women in music, as I alluded to in your biography, and you kind of talked a little bit about what it means to be a performer, a teacher, and a mentor, as you do all of those things all the time, it seems as if, and that you were concerned primarily with four unique things or four different things. Can you talk us through what you mean when you said the technical, if you can remember that?
Why don't you remind me of those?
Yes, I was going to. Don't worry. We've got the list right here. So you mentioned the technical, the analytical, the diagnostic, and the practical, and how that relates to your playing and to how you engage and interact with your students.
Wow. Okay. I said that, did I?
Okay.
So, I think I remember mentioning that because... When dealing with students, you know, I have to teach them what I know about that sort of self-assessment process I had mentioned before. You know, how do you decide what's weak in your playing and in your technical development, and how do you decide what else you need? And then once you've made those choices, how do you work on them? And once you've done that, how do you reintegrate all of that into a musical context? And then how do you package that into something you can take on stage? I think the performance needs to be practiced as well. So, you know, there are these different stages, which I'm sure if you talk to each one of us here at the festival, we'd give you sort of a different recipe for how to get there, how to actually walk out the door and sit down on stage. But that's a big part of my process, so I share that with students. And I sort of mentioned that by way of addressing the topic of women in music, because I wanted to show them that a lot of the time that I do spend with students has nothing to do with anyone's gender, you know. It's just such a very focused time together with whatever young person is across from me. And it, as it happens, there are more women in music schools today than ever before, so much so that I think I had only one young man in my class during the last year at UMass, and we all laughed. We're like, look, everything's changed.
Topsy-turvy. But it's terrific. Also in that conversation that you had, you talked about traveling with the Lark Quartet and sort of some of the response being an all-women ensemble. And hopefully that has changed, I would hope.
Oh, yes.
These days.
Yes, it has. I think the Seneca's referring to an incident, but this happened many times over, but the quartet would travel to a venue and arrive with, you know, wearing backpacks as I did today and carrying our instruments. And we were in our 20s, you know, so I guess we looked like we were either students or just, you know, young women having fun with music. And people would say, so what do you do in your real life? Or, well, you know, when you're not. And the fact that we were actually rehearsing 7 days a week, you know, maybe 360 days a year, just never occurred to them. Yeah.
Well, hopefully that is starting to change. I mean, I know it's a conversation beyond just the borders of music.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, absolutely. It is. It's a deep societal conversation.
Yeah.
But it is. I am happy to report that I do see, you know, positive change.
Yeah, that's terrific. Yeah, it was a fascinating talk. I mean, it's online, so encourage everyone to sit down and watch it. You had a great panel that you were a part of there.
Yeah.
So it was a lot of fun. Well, let's keep listening to music here. You know, I think one of the things, as I've listened through a lot of your playing, the slow movements feel so fluid, it's liquidy almost. I mean, in a very great, good way.
Liquidy, like, I like that.
Just this long, seemingly never-ending line, and so I thought we would listen to some of the Arensky from that Boston Trio recording,
nice.
the Elegy, and just this beautiful, beautiful piece, so... let's listen to that.
Okay.
Very sinuous. It's sort of...
It's a beautiful piece.
Yeah.
It really is.
And beautiful, beautifully played.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. There's a new project that you have recently worked on called Rhapsody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I thought, you know, we're just going to jump right back into some music here, but I thought before we talked about it, it would be interesting to hear a little bit of it because it's a different kind of project.
It's a different sort of project
than what you've been working on or what we've been listening to this afternoon already. So I thought let's just jump into a piece, Dialogue, and we'll start to talk a little bit about the piece as after we hear it.
Okay.
So
okay.
So this piece is rather unique. It's actually for an electric cello.
It is, yes.
And the Phantom Orchestra, I think, is how it was referred to. So is this something that you play very often?
You know, I did play it quite a bit over the last few seasons. Mm-hmm. I have. And I'm looking forward to doing some more concerts. This was written actually by my husband, Gordon Green, And he wrote it for me as kind of an experiment because we... Should I tell the story now?
Yeah, feel free. Let's dive into it.
Okay. We were traveling quite a bit together on weekends many years ago to visit some sick family members, and I needed to stay in shape while traveling, so we bought a Yamaha electric practice cello. And when, you know, it was a wonderfully convenient thing, especially in a hotel, to be able to just play late at night when people are sleeping and they can't hear you. And then finally, one day, he plugged it in for me when we were back at home. He has an elaborate music lab with all sorts of technical stuff going on in there. It's incredible. And so he plugged in the cello. He said, "I thought it might be fun to have, you know, just try a little improvisation. Why don't you just noodle around, and I'll try some different effects." And so I did, and you know, a couple hours later, we stopped, and I went off to practice. And it turns out he used some of those improvisations to weave a kind of backing track. Hmm. And that served as the basis for this 15-movement work, which has movements sort of like this. This is a very short movement with you know, a piano sound that is not an actual piano that's playing. These are all synthesized effects that he managed. And I just think it's a wonderful piece. I really love playing it. It's an investment to get all 15 movements here and in my hands. And that's been an interesting challenge for a married couple as Gordon continued to add movements to the process.
Honey, that's enough.
That's enough. It's long enough.
Is it something that you play often as far as like the actual cello?
The Yamaha.
Do you play an electric cello very often? Or?
You know, it's funny. It's in our apartment in New York. And so for late night practice, I use that.
Yeah.
This cello that I have with me here is not a friend to neighbors in an apartment building. So that cello and I are very familiar with each other. And I have actually, I think on occasion, done some off the beaten track performances of movements of Rhapsody along with Bach. Mm-hmm. On the Yamaha, and we have our own little speakers that we travel with, very fancy Bose speakers. Mm-hmm. So the sound is quite nice, and it's been an interesting way to reach different sorts of audiences.
Fun. Yeah. No, it's you know, I've seen a little clip online, and you know, looking at the piece, it feels like it's a very multimedia piece. It's you know, not just the cello and the electronics, but there's a visual component. Can you kind of talk a little bit about the structure of the piece, I guess, and, uh-huh. and the performances?
Yeah. Well, we decided that because this piece is so kind of unique and elaborate in its way, that it would really benefit from having a visual component, and we commissioned these two wonderful young production people. One is Masha Zimring, fantastic lighting designer, and her partner. Together, they put together this sort of lighting display and series of images that appear on screen behind us as we're on stage. And they're very evocative, and they sort of move in tempo with the music, and it's a unique kind of thing. I never get to see it, of course, because my back is always to this interesting work behind me. We always joke because, you know, Gordon did all this work to compose this wonderful piece, and then on stage he's basically pushing buttons, and you know, he said he's not nearly active enough, so it also made us think that we should have a little something else going on.
Very nice. It's as you talked about, each piece has a theme or is evocative of something. You know, maybe not necessarily working through all of it, but like the idea that the piece that we listen to, Dialogue, is that a dialogue between you and the you know, electronic component? Uh-huh. Is it a dialogue of some other kind? There's another piece called Monologue.
Yes.
So like, what are some of the you know, the thoughts, I guess, behind those movements?
Well, this idea, I think you put your finger on it. This particular movement that we just heard with the piano-esque sounds and cello definitely is a dialogue between us, and there are I guess this motivic gestures that one of us will set off and the other will kind of emulate or reverberate from.
Great.
Sort of weird image, but and then the monologue is just the cello unaccompanied.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it has a little bit of it's the only piece in the entire work, the only movement in which the cello speaks on its own.
Yeah. Does he mix or arrange the cello so that it has more reverb or anything as you're playing, or?
You know, he does when I play the Yamaha, mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, he does have to, because some of the backing track gets very rich and almost like Mahler, or, yeah. You know, or Strauss. And it's in that little, no matter what I do to the little Yamaha, it only has a finite amount of volume.
Yeah.
And I always have to make sure the batteries are fresh. And the, yeah.
Batteries not included. But terrific. Well, you know, I mentioned sort of that fluid tone of the instrument. I thought we would listen to one more track here, the final track of that piece, Rhapsody, mm-hmm. Sunset. And, you know, maybe you can talk us a little bit about through this piece as well.
Okay.
Do you want to set it up for us?
Sure. This last movement, Sunset, mirrors the opening movement, which is entitled Aurora. And these have sort of, I don't know, I don't want to put thoughts in your minds too much, but there's a spaciousness to these movements and a kind of epic feel, I think he was trying to convey. Mm. And they're a real pleasure to play. It's difficult because there's no, there's nothing for me to listen to or hang on to or see, really. I have to kind of learn the timing of the backing track and anticipate. So I find it was funny. I saw some pictures of myself in concert playing the Rhapsody, and I'm staring at the speakers because I always tend to look at what I'm listening to.
They're not giving you a lot of cues, though.
The speakers are strangely inert. Yeah.
Well, let's listen to just a little bit of Sunset here.
Okay.
Snippet to make people want to listen to more.
Taster.
With an electric cello, does it produce dynamics like a regular cello? Or are you sort of, I mean, it seems like you're sort of stuck with the sound as you play.
Yeah.
It's going to be consistent. So there really is a arc in this piece.
Yes, that's a really great question. And I have to, you know, in the interest of full disclosure, I have to say that I used my real cello to record this because I wanted enough tonal variety and control. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to leave it to, you know, Gordon or the technician we hired to do this to get it all on captured, you know, and recording to fix things. So that was recorded on my nice French cello. But the Yamaha has a very limited range. It's decent for practicing by yourself. Mm-hmm. Once you plug it in, you have a volume control and you can do quite a lot with it. But it's frustrating in the sense that it doesn't offer depth. There's certainly, you can do some nuance of sound, but if you want to go deeper, for example, into the lower registers, you know, it just sort of bottoms out pretty quickly. Yeah. And yeah.
Yeah, terrific. You kind of alluded to the cello that you used here for the recording.
Yeah.
What instrument do you use, or what do you play?
Well, that cello is my Viom, which mm-hmm. I'm very fortunate to own. My parents made a very big sacrifice when they could see that this was really going to happen somehow, this life in music.
The choice, yeah.
Yeah, and so it's a JB Viom, and I've had it since I was 19.
Wow.
So, yeah, we've really grown together.
A lot of years with it,
we've changed
Not
each other.
Not that many years with it. I apologize.
That's really funny, Zenek. Yes, right. That was at least 5 years ago.
Perfect.
So, and the cello I'm using now for these concerts and for my season with the quartet, I have a Stradivarius that I've been fortunate to use from Juilliard, and it's a very lovely and, you know, endlessly, you know, deep instrument.
Yeah, so that's a new instrument, obviously.
Yeah.
How comfortable, or how long does it take to feel comfortable sort of with what it can do after using an instrument, the other one, for 5 years or so? But to use a new instrument that obviously people would kill to have that,
yeah.
But at the same time, you know, you had created a relationship With the other cello.
Yes. Well, my other cello and I are still very much in touch. And but yes, the change, the difference between the instruments is surprisingly great. They're about the same size in their physique, mm-hmm. but the French cello really requires a much heavier hand. So I actually have a heavier bow that I use with that cello. And I'm able to and have to save bow. It responds better to a slower bow speed. Whereas the Stradivarius does not like a slow bow at all. And I have, on occasion, you know, been reminded by an errant squawk that move your bow faster. So this cello definitely calls the shots and it lets me know what it needs to stay resonating.
Terrific.
Yeah.
Well, beautiful playing that we've had this week.
Thank you.
It has been a joy to listen to some recordings as well. Thank you so much, time. I know it's busy, but we really appreciate you coming in and chatting with us here while you've been here in Seattle for the Summer Festival.
Thank you, Seneca.
Again, our guest today is cellist of the Juilliard String Quartet, Astrid Schwein.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been fun.
Good. It's our pleasure, and we'd love to have you back.
Thank you.
This live recording of our Classical Conversation podcast was recorded live on July 21st at Soundbridge at Benaroya Hall. I'm your host, Seneca Garber. This is our sixth season of podcasts. You can find previous conversations found on our website, www.seattlechambermusic.org, or on iTunes. I want to thank our audio engineer, Bill Levy, today, and our partners at King FM. Seattle Chamber Music Society produces this podcast series. Right now, the Summer Festival runs through July 29th, and our final concert will be live up at Volunteer Park, so we hope to see everyone at that. Thank you so much again for joining us.